Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic Book Blogger, and this week we have with us Joseph Pierce. He's a senior contributor of the Imaginative Conservative. He is senior editor at the Augustine Institute and Tolkien and Lewis Chair in Literary Studies at Holy Apostles College and Seminary. He's the editor of the St. Augustine Review, series editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions, and executive editor of Catholic Courses. His books include The Quest for Shakespeare, Tolkien, Man and Myth, C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, and Wisdom and Innocence, A Life of G.K. Chesterton. Today we'll be discussing two other titles. More recently released Heroes of the Catholic Reformation, Saints Who Renewed the Church from our Sunday Visitor, and Frodo's Journey Discovering the Hidden Meaning of the Lord of the Rings. Welcome to the show, Joseph.
It's good to be on, Pete.
Awesome. And we've talked before, Joseph, but never here in my new home in Breadbox Media. So I'm looking forward to having you as a guest and sharing some insights from you with our audience. So we'll begin with this. We're rapidly approaching the 500-year anniversary of the start of the Reformation, kicked off by Martin Luther and his 95 Theses on October 31st, 1517, thus kicking off unprecedented division and turmoil in Christianity. And to outline our conversation, you make a point in the beginning chapter of your book, Heroes of the Catholic Reformation, that there are actually three definable reformations. So I'd like to touch upon that so everyone has a clear understanding of these, and the first being the English Reformation.
Yes, I think it's a mistake to conflate the two Protestant Reformations, shall we say. When we talk about the Reformation, we normally just do think of Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, and the folks on the continent. But the English Reformation is a very distinct thing, and it's not even primarily theological. Basically, the English Reformation is based upon the secularist aims and ambitions of Henry VIII, not to mention his own personal lustful appetites. So basically, the English Reformation, where it is a case of Caesar seizing the power of the church and basically establishing a state religion which becomes compulsory, and outlawing the Catholic religion, which actually becomes a dangerous religion to practice, and indeed a deadly religion to practice.
Which leads us into that whole Catholic Reformation. But first, what about the Protestant Reformation? What sets that apart from the English Reformation?
Well, Henry VIII, who basically led the English Reformation by declaring himself to be head of the church, was very opposed to Luther and to the Protestants on the continent, and indeed he authored a small book called In Defense of the Seven Sacraments as an attack on Luther, and even asked both Thomas More and John Fisher, both of whom he would subsequently have executed, to preach and teach against the errors of Luther. So basically, on the continent, you do have what we might call a rupture in the church on basis of theology. We have Luther and later Calvin and others basically preaching a form of Christianity which is heretical and which is at war with the doctrines of the church. And so we have, if you like, Europe, or at least parts of Europe, being ripped apart by this Protestant Reformation. But it's very distinct from what's happening in England at the same time.
So in some sense, did Henry VIII do the Catholic Church some good by standing up in some ways against Luther?
Well, perhaps in the very short term, but obviously only for 10 or 15 years or so. Obviously, Luther, as you rightly say, began the Protestant Reformation of 1517, and the English Reformation, if we want to call it that, under Henry VIII, but didn't begin until the late 1529, 1530, 1531. So there's a period of about 12 years or so when Henry VIII was a champion of the Catholic Church, and indeed the Pope gave him the title Fidei Defensor, Defender of the Faith, which is ironic to say the least. And what's a continuing irony is that Fidei Defensor is still carried by the monarchs today and is still actually printed on the coins in the UK. But of course it was granted by the Pope to Henry VIII when, during that period of time, when he was a defender of the teachings of the church against the heresies of Luther.
So now we come upon the Catholic Reformation, which you point out led to a renewal of the Catholic faith. How so?
Well, I think, you know, what we actually see from history is that those two, should we say, bad reformations, the English Reformation and the Protestant Reformation, caused within the church a Catholic Reformation, and the 16th century became really a golden age for the Catholic Church, as the Catholic Church responded to the Reformation with something which is called the Counter-Reformation. But to me, that's an inadequate term, because it basically means that all that the Catholic Church was doing at the time was countering the Protestant Reformation, whereas in actual fact, as my book shows, there was a great genuine reformation of the Catholic Church, culminating perhaps in the Council of Trent during the 16th century, which makes the Catholic Reformation, for me, the one which is the most powerful and the most lasting. We see the Anglican Church dissolving. We see the Protestant churches exploding into hundreds and hundreds of different sects and churches that differ from each other. But the Catholic Church, the legacy we have now 500 years on, is the legacy of that Catholic Reformation. The Tridentine Church, the Church of the Council of Trent, and all the glorious saints and reforms that came from that period of history.
Mm-hmm. So now the big question, why is the Reformation so important for us as Catholics to understand today?
Well, I mean, first of all, in the most general sense of all, that we need to have an understanding of history, because history is what's made the world in which we live, and we won't understand where we're going as a church or as a society if we don't know where we've been. Because basically, if you like, we chart the map of the past to see the direction in which things are going. And so, first of all, in a general sense, we need to understand history. But secondly, I think that, you know, obviously the church and Catholics need to understand the rich heritage of, first of all, the lives of the saints, those heroes of the church that should inspire us to emulate them and to grow in holiness and virtue ourselves, and also the reforms and teachings that came about, and the religious orders that were formed all during this period of the 16th century, which is the focus of my book.
Right. Now, again, great book. You actually highlight a number of these saints that appeared during that time period and were involved in this Catholic Reformation, and you define them as heroes. Why so?
Well, there's an early chapter in my book when I talk about heroism and holiness, and basically say that the two things are the same. That there's a secular understanding of heroism. You know, we have the sort of superheroes of Marvel comics, or maybe the heroes, the great statesmen of each individual nation that perhaps were influential in the history of that nation. But a secular heroism is very different from the heroism of a saint, because what true heroism is, it's basically to love as we're meant to love, and basically to follow the two commandments of Christ, to love the Lord thy God and to love thy neighbor. And a life spent doing those commandments is true heroism. So for me, holiness and heroism are synonymous, as indeed on the level of reason and philosophy, sanctity and sanity are synonymous, because ultimately sin, understood objectively, is an act of madness. It's an act of not doing what we should do in the light of the fact that we're made in the image of Almighty God.
Mm-hmm. So as we go through these saints, I want to point out a couple of them here to listeners. And the first ones you really look at are, you already touched upon them briefly in the one question, was John Fisher and Thomas More, who were, I guess, in some sense used by Henry VIII. Can you tell us a little bit about them and their story?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously they are now canonized martyrs of the church. They were amongst the earliest victims, should we say, of Henry VIII's Reformation. They were martyrs. And we need to understand how shocking this was to Christendom, to have Christians being put to death by the power of the state. When Thomas Becket had been killed, martyred on the orders of the king several hundred years earlier, it shocked Christendom so much that Canterbury, where he was martyred, became one of the major pilgrimage destinations of medieval Europe. So, you know, because Christendom had largely been at least united in faith, even if divided in politics, the idea of someone being martyred for Christianity was really shocking. And of course, St. John Fisher and St. Thomas Thomas More were both beheaded on the orders of Henry VIII for the hideous crime of staying true to the Catholic Church in the face of this new secularist tyranny.
It's interesting you bring up that point about martyrdom, especially with these two saints. You know, it seems like even today, martyrdom is a shocking thing, but because it seems, and I think it's important for people to understand that martyrdom still does occur today, because a lot of people tend to think that was an early Christian thing.
Yeah, it's a big mistake. I mean, and I think I, up to a point, it's a mistake that's been largely propagated by Protestants, because they are comfortable with the early church and uncomfortable with the medieval church, and certainly uncomfortable with the saints since the Reformation. But yes, martyrdom has carried on in every single century, and indeed in the 20th century, arguably there were more martyrs than in any other century, just because the sheer scale of murder that secularism carried out in the name of communism and fascism and Nazism in the 20th century. But the point is that in the 16th century, it had been unheard of within Europe for someone to be put to death for practicing and preaching the Catholic faith. So when news was heard throughout Europe, and indeed in England itself, that these two holy men, both of whom had been greatly esteemed, including by the king himself, for their wisdom, their knowledge, their grasp of theology, philosophy, as well as the holiness of their lives, when these men were put to death for the crime basically of defying the will of Caesar, the will of the king, refusing, if you like, to render unto Caesar those things which are God's, it was indeed a shock to the world.
Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Pete Sox, Catholic Book Blogger, and we'll be right back with more from Joseph. John Fisher and Sir Thomas More. And lest people think that men were the only ones involved with this Catholic Reformation, you also cover Teresa of Avila. Can you tell us a bit about her contributions to this time period?
Yes, indeed I can. I mean, one of the things that Luther was complaining about, with an element of justification, was an element of laxity, an element of corruption in aspects of the church. And although this was greatly exaggerated once the Protestant Reformation was dealing in terms of propaganda, it was nonetheless true. And that was true of some of the religious orders. And Teresa of Avila reformed the Carmelite order, basically seeking to make it much more disciplined in terms of its prayer life, in terms of the austerity of the life of the sisters themselves. And in spite of opposition from within the Carmelite order, as a woman who really was irrepressible, and with the assistance of St. John of the Cross, who I also cover in the book, she succeeded in this wonderful reform of the Carmelite order, which itself was inspirational. And of course, she and St. John of the Cross were both great mystics who have inspired the church with their writings, and in St. John of the Cross's case with their poetry, and indeed have inspired poetry and art in others. Some we think of great works of art inspired, for instance, of the Bernini's The Ecstasy of Saint Teresa in Rome is one of the greatest masterpieces of sculpture ever produced, and that was of course inspired by the mysticism of Saint Teresa of Avila. Mm.
You've touched upon that whole mysticism and mystic definition. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I don't think people may not understand what it means to be a mystic.
Yeah, and I think we do need to understand what there's more than one form of mysticism. Mm-hmm. I think it was Monsignor Ronald Knox, who said that mysticism begins in mist and ends in schism. In other words, that if mysticism is not tied or anchored to orthodoxy, it goes in all sorts of odd and weird directions and very quickly becomes heretical. So we do need to be wary of mysticism. But we do know that if a mystic has been canonized by the Church, as is the case with St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, we know that their mysticism is trustworthy. And in their case, basically, it was being taken, if you like, transported out of themselves spiritually by a deep mystical communion with the presence of God in their lives, and the manner in which they managed to express with eloquence that experience. St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, very poetic in their use of the English language and allowing us at least an inkling of the mystical experiences that they had. Of course, you know, that there's a shadow that falls when we try to relay these mystical, miraculous moments of union with the divine presence in our lives. But in the cases of St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, not only was that mystical presence intensely strong, but they managed to convey that intensely strong relationship with the divine presence in a language which allows us to, up to a point, at least share it.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've been talking a lot about Henry VIII here, and I want to backtrack a little bit. You know, before people began to think this was just an England thing, this was actually a continental Europe Reformation. And you lead off chapter 5, speaking of Ignatius Loyola and Francis Xavier, and we'll talk about them in a bit, but you say, leaving the oppressive atmosphere of England with its secular tyrant Henry VIII butchering his opponents with almost psychopathic abandon, we crossed the channel to continental Europe. And again, this was an entire European Reformation or a European issue. How did Loyola and Xavier contribute?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, St. Ignatius Loyola and St. Francis Xavier were founding members of the Jesuit order. St. Ignatius was the leader, the founder of the Jesuit order, but St. Francis Xavier was amongst that small group of friends who founded the Jesuits. And the Jesuits, of course, were a major force for evangelization in the world, both in fighting heresy within Europe and in spreading the gospel throughout the world. St. Francis Xavier, particularly, of course, with his apostolate to the east, to India and beyond. That was the other factor, if you like, of the Catholic Reformation, was this missionary zeal that we see in many of these Jesuits in particular at the time.
And I think when we're talking about this entire thing, we have to look at the hierarchy of the Church itself, and you include Pope Pius V as one of the heroes of this Catholic Reformation. You refer to G.K. Chesterton's poem Lepanto, where he will always be called the Pope who called the kings of Christendom for swords about the cross. Can you tell us a bit about what Pius's contribution was? Because it's interesting that in looking at this entire period of time, it's almost like this grand chess game is laid out in the continent of Europe, where the Church is moving some pieces and the royalty of England is moving the others.
Yes, exactly. And we do need to realize, and I hope that my chapter on St. Pius V shows this, that, you know, that it's very important for the Church to have strong leadership from the papacy. And obviously the Church has survived many, many bad popes throughout its 2,000 years of existence. So, you know, it's not that the Church depends upon the holiness of the Pope, but it certainly does help greatly when the Pope is, first of all, a holy man and a saint, which Pius V was, but also a leader who was courageous in the face of powerful enemies. And we do need to remember, you know, we're often sort of tempted to think that we live in the worst of times, and that's another value of knowing history, when we see how bad things have been in the past. Because, you know, at the time in the mid 1500s and the late 1500s, at the time of St. Pius V, you know, you had on the one hand Northern Europe being ripped apart by the heresies of Luther and Calvin. You had England being ripped away from the church by the tyranny of Henry VIII and later Elizabeth I. You had the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic empire to the south, Islamist militancy advancing. It would get as far through into Europe as Vienna. We can't really imagine that, but basically the whole of southern Europe, south of Vienna, was under Muslim control. And then again, we had the Battle of Lepanto, as you rightly say, where the Holy Father calls together a Holy League to fight this invading Islamic fleet. And most of Europe ignores his request, because parts of Europe are actually on the side of the Muslims for political reasons. France is actually allied with the Muslims, and England, of course, is considers Rome to be a bigger enemy than Islam. So but with the handful of Christian states that responded to the Pope's call under the leadership of Don John of Austria, Europe was delivered from that Islamic invasion. And if that battle hadn't been won, it's entirely possible that St. Peter's in Rome would now be a mosque.
Interesting observation. Let me ask one more question, then we'll come back to that statement. We live in dark times. People keep bringing up this topic of spiritual warfare. It keeps popping up in my radar with these shows and talking to different authors. And we really are. But what can we learn from the Catholic Reformation to help us in this spiritual battle we face today?
Well, I think what we need to realize is that the truths that our Lord gave us in the gospel when he was walking on the earth are timeless, and that the things he says, such as the fact that he brings a sword, are something we need to remember. That in every single generation there's a temptation that runs through every single individual heart, our own included, to either serve the forces of the world, which are ultimately the forces of darkness, or to serve the Lord our God. And that's a temptation that runs through the heart of every human being. And as it runs through the heart of every human being, it runs through the heart of every human society. So when Tolkien, for instance, J.R.R. Tolkien talks about history as the long defeat with only occasional glimpses of final victory, he's really alluding to this fact that, within the secular understanding of things, the secular powers are always more powerful than the church. The church is never in charge of the world, and nor is she meant to be. Ultimately, she's in charge of getting souls to heaven and leaving the judgment of the world ultimately to our Lord and Savior at the time that he decides. But for us, we have to work out our own salvation under grace through doing what he commands and by trying to persuade other people to do the same. But we're not going to make a heaven on earth. We're not utopians. We don't believe that that evil can be defeated this side of heaven. Ultimately, it'll be defeated by God, and we can obviously be his agents in combating it. But we need to understand that every single century is full of this battle, this endless battle between the forces of the world, the forces of darkness, and the forces of the church, the forces of light.
Mm-hmm. Now back to that Battle of Lepanto. We've seen in recent months the allowance of immigration of Muslims into England and some of the bad things that have occurred because of that. Are we, in your opinion, facing another Lepanto-type moment?
Well, certainly there are similarities and differences. I would say that that we need to make things perfectly clear here that the dangers of Islamic immigration are nothing whatsoever to do with race. And it seems that whenever anybody mentions the word immigration, it immediately becomes charged with the notion of race.
Correct.
No, it doesn't matter what color the Muslims are. That if you have a large Islamic presence in the midst of a Christian country, what you have is a ghettoized, balkanized society where the Muslims minority effectively declares war on the host culture. And this is not just a question of theory. This is a question of observable fact, not just in England, but in Germany and in France and in any other country which has made the mistake of allowing large numbers of Muslims to enter. You know, the whole point is, you know, that a black Christian is a Christian, mm-hmm. and a white Muslim is a Muslim, and it's the religion which is the problem and not the race.
Right, right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. To share with everyone the last paragraph of the book, which I think segues nicely into the next book we're going to speak about, and that paragraph reads as such. We live in dark and doom-laden days. So did the heroes of the Catholic Reformation. So do all men in all ages in this fallen and broken world. We cannot choose the time in which we live, but we can choose the way that we live in the time that is given to us. This is the choice. This is a challenge. This is the hero's quest. I think it's a very poignant statement and a great way to put an exclamation point at the end of that book, Joseph. It is really about how we choose to live our lives.
Yes, indeed. And as you were rightly alluding there, although I didn't attribute it, I stole some words from the great Gandalf the Grey in that last paragraph. It's Gandalf that says it's not for us to choose the time that we're given, but what we do with the time given us. So yes, it is about that we shouldn't just wring our hands together and say, woe is me, look at why was I born in such a corrupt time. You know, we all generations were born in corrupt times, and that's not the point. The point is what we do with the corrupt times in which we're born.
Right. And again, that paragraph segues nicely into your book, Frodo's Journey, Discovering the Hidden Meaning of the Lord of the Rings. To start with, what does the tale of Frodo Baggins hold for us today?
Well, we should realize that the Lord of the Rings is the third largest selling book of all time, which is astonishing. Leaving aside the religious texts such as the Bible and the Quran, mm-hmm. but apart from Don Quixote and A Tale of Two Cities, the Lord of the Rings is the biggest selling book ever. And bearing in mind that unlike those two books, first of all, it's published much more recently, and secondly, it's hardly ever taught as a set text at school, whereas I suspect that most people that read Don Quixote and A Tale of Two Cities do so because they have to at school. not to say that they're not great books, of course.
Right.
But The Lord of the Rings, people buy it because they want to read it. So it's a phenomenal success, and Tolkien said, and I'm quoting him word for word here, quote, "The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work." End quote. So the point is that, you know, the millions and millions of people that have read The Lord of the Rings, of all religions and none, and whether they know it or not, are actually finding themselves deeply attracted to the depths of the fundamentally religious and Catholic dimension of that work.
Right, right. So what are some of the Christian undercurrents in Tolkien's classic, The Lord of the Rings?
Well, I mean, they're numerous. Tolkien says in his famous essay and lecture on fairy stories that fairy stories hold up a mirror to man. In other words, they show us ourselves. So in that sense, The Lord of the Rings is a realistic work because it shows us who we are as human beings. So we can see in The Lord of the Rings both everyman figures. In one sense, Frodo Baggins is an example of Homo Viator. That's a Latin for journeying man or man. man on the quest, man on the journey. And we do have to understand that unlike the secular world, the Christians understand that our primary purpose on earth is to get to heaven. That means that every life is a life journey, and every life is a life quest, during which we're going to face all sorts of temptations and dangers to get off track and get sidetracked and miss the goal and fail in the quest. So really, you know, this understanding of the journey, of Bilbo's journey or Bilbo's quest, is a reflection of our own journey and our own quest to get to heaven.
It's interesting, in the book you open, and it was actually the second chapter of The Mirror Man, where Tolkien talks about hobbits and comparing them to himself as a man. And in the one, you pull this section out of one of his letters where he says, "I am in fact a hobbit in all but size. I like gardens, trees, and unmechanized farmlands. I smoke a pipe and like good plain food, unrefrigerated. I like and even dare to wear in these dull days ornamental waistcoats. I'm fond of mushrooms out of a field, have a very simple sense of humor, which even my appreciative critics find tiresome. I go to bed late and get up late when possible. I do not travel much." So what were some of the influences Tolkien used in the world around him to put into this magnificent new world he created?
Well, I'm glad you read that letter, because as you can see from that letter that basically, you know, Tolkien says, "I am in fact a hobbit." We can see that the hobbits are indeed meant to reflect a certain type of who we are. If you like, it's the exaltation of the humble. Not to say that Frodo Baggins and Bilbo Baggins and the other hobbits don't have their own problems. They're not perfect. But they are humble. They're not the great. They're the ordinary. And I think that most of us would see ourselves as not the great, but the ordinary. And in that sense, if you like, putting the focus on the little man is an exaltation of the humble. And that's certainly another aspect of the Christian dimension of The Lord of the Rings.
And then you continue further with in the book, where you talk about, you in effect are comparing Middle Earth with the Middle Ages. Can you give us some idea of how that happened?
Yes, I mean, basically, Tolkien, first of all, academically, was a medievalist. He was a philologist, an expert in languages, but the languages he chose to be an expert in were medieval languages, so Old English, the English before the Norman conquest, and Old Norse, the language spoken by the Vikings. So, you know, he was steeped in this medieval milieu, I think, but he was also aesthetically medieval in the sense that he actually preferred a simple, unmechanized, a techno-minimalist approach, if you like, to life. And by setting Middle Earth in a pre-mechanical age, which was, as he said himself in another letter, "I was born in the pre-mechanical age." He wasn't born in the pre-mechanical age, of course. He was born right in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. But he did experience life in an English village in an age that was certainly nowhere near as mechanical and technological as it would become. So he did, if you like, have an inkling from his childhood, playing in ponds and climbing trees in a small village in Warwickshire, of this idyllic England. And basically what Middle-earth, I think, or certainly the Shire, at least, is, I think, a depiction of an idealized or idyllic medieval England.
Mm. So you also discuss in this book correlations of events in The Lord of the Rings with the Christian calendar. Can you tell us a bit about those correlations and what we maybe don't pick up on?
Yeah, basically, I think this is the most important aspect of The Lord of the Rings, in the sense that the correlation between certain dates of events in The Lord of the Rings with dates in the liturgical calendar allow us to unlock the deepest meanings of The Lord of the Rings. In that sense, they are the key that we need. So, for instance, to give some examples, the ring is destroyed on March the 25th. Now, Catholics will know, of course, that March the 25th is the Feast of the Annunciation. And that's obviously a very, very important feast, and more important than Christmas, insofar as life begins at conception and not at birth, and therefore God becomes man at the Annunciation and not the Nativity. The Word is made flesh on March the 25th. But what many people don't know, even if they do know that, and of course many Christian readers of The Lord of the Rings would not know that, so it would pass them by, that reference to March the 25th being the date on which the ring is destroyed. But what many people don't know, even Catholics, Catholics is that the early church and the medieval church believed that the actual historical date of the crucifixion itself was March the 25th. So what Tolkien does, and of course Tolkien as a medievalist knew that very well, what Tolkien does is to make the ring, have the ring destroyed on March the 25th. And of course the incarnation, the life, death, and resurrection of Christ destroys the power of sin on March the 25th. So that being so, we can see the ring as being synonymous with sin itself. And once you see the ring as being synonymous with sin, all sorts of other meanings unfold before our eyes in the deepest understanding of the Lord of the Rings.
Isn't it interesting that Tolkien sprinkles this Catholicism into the Lord of the Rings, but he wasn't Catholic? I mean, he didn't in the end convert to Catholicism, though some think that he was very close to doing so.
I think at this point, actually, Peter, you're getting Tolkien confused with C.S. Lewis.
Oh, you're right.
Tolkien was a lifelong practicing Catholic.
Yes, correct.
That's something we need to remember. In fact, that Tolkien's Catholicism is an integral part of the fabric of his work, because it was an integral part of the fabric of his life. It was inseparable, if you like, to who he was as a person, and therefore was inseparable to who he was as a writer.
Right. You're correct. You're right. It was C.S. Lewis that was not Catholic. And Tolkien had an influence on C.S. Lewis because of the writing group they were in. But since we brought that up, let's talk about it a little bit. What was the influence Tolkien had on C.S. Lewis? Because both of their book series are intertwined in a sense because they're read by many of the same fan base.
Exactly. And the first and most important influence that Tolkien had on C.S. Lewis was that Tolkien was a very major influence on Lewis's conversion from atheism to Christianity. And it was largely Tolkien's philosophy of myth, his understanding of the truths that could be found in stories, which opened Lewis's mind and eyes to the truths of Christianity. Because Tolkien said to Lewis that Christianity was the true myth, the myth that really happened. In other words, the most important story of all, which actually happens in history and not merely in the mind of an author, and that the author of this story enters the story himself, of course, in the incarnation. So when Tolkien made that fact clear to C.S. Lewis, it was crucial. And within a week or two of Tolkien enlightening Lewis in this way, Lewis declared himself to be a Christian. And of course, that philosophy of myth animates Tolkien's work, The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, and The Silmarillion, etc. And also the works of C.S. Lewis, the Space Trilogy, and the Chronicles of Narnia in particular.
Which are all fantastic reads. With that, we're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Me and my guest, Joseph Pierce, will be right back. And we've segued into Frodo's journey discovering the hidden meaning of the Lord of the Rings, something a little lighter than the first book we discussed, but just as important, both of them. One of the things you talk about in this book, Joseph, is the character of Tom Bombadil and the fact that he was left out of the movies, and which may in some sense, have been a mistake, because he played a pretty big, important role in the book. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, indeed. And I often give talks on unlocking the Lord of the Rings, and I don't mention Tom Bombadil in my talk either, which can be seen to be a sin, perhaps analogous to Peter Jackson's leaving out of Tom Bombadil from his movies. But I think that the same reason applies, not because that Tom is not important, he's crucially important, but, you know, within the constraints of a very limited time, so 45 to 50 minutes for talk, or the 9 or 10 hours or something that that Jackson had for his movies, that Tom Bombadil, it's difficult to squeeze him in. But in the book, he plays an important role. And we know this for many reasons, but two of the principal ones. First of all, Tom reveals himself to be the oldest living creature in Middle-earth. He's there before the elves. He's the eldest. That's what I am. That's what he says. So that's the first thing. If someone's the eldest creature there, we really need to take him seriously. And also, after the ring is destroyed, the first thing that Gandalf declares he needs to do as a matter of urgency is go and have a long talk with Tom Bombadil. So Tom Bombadil is much more important as far as Gandalf's concerned in the light of the destruction of the ring than Elrond or the elves or anybody else. So he's clearly an important figure. In my book, I have the liberty in a book, which I don't in a talk, to spend a whole chapter on Tom Bombadil. The chapter's called The Enigma of Tom Bombadil, in which basically I show from the evidence of what he does and who he is, what he says about himself in the book, that Tom and his wife Goldberry are a reflection, a representation, if you like, of the unfallen Adam and Eve. So that aspect of creation, which is not subject to evil.
Hmm. One of the things in The Lord of the Rings I like to touch upon is the presence of magic. And you dedicate a chapter to this topic in the book.
We know there's indeed.
We do know that there's been some controversy with Harry Potter and the magic involved in that. So what is the role and how can people approach magic being in these books?
Yeah, the first thing is that Tolkien treats magic, and so does C.S. Lewis, in a way that's entirely orthodox. In other words, that some things that we might call magic are not magic at all. They're miracle. So there's some powers that are supernatural that characters such as Gandalf has, for instance. Gandalf is actually an angelic being, and as an angelic being, he has angelic powers, which are supernatural powers. So this is the power that we see in the angels and the saints, but that are being, or in the miracles of Christ. This is supernatural power. The downside of that, the dark side of that, of course, is demonic power. Now, the devil and his demons are fallen angels, so they also have angelic power, which is supernatural power. So that for Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings, we might call that magic, but that is, if you like, a better word for it would be miracle, and if you like, the anti-miracle of demonic supernatural power. And then we have natural powers that are not really magical at all. So, for instance, you know, hobbits and elves have an ability to disappear before we see them, but the power that they have is they don't physically disappear, they just get out of sight. And the sort of power they have is the sort of power that mammals have in the woods. If we walk along through the woods noisily, all of the animals get out of the way before we see them because they have a sense of smell or a sense of eyesight or a sense of hearing, which is natural to them. But if we had that power, if we had as good an eyesight or a good hearing as some of these animals, it would be, you know, superhuman. But it's natural to them. So some of these so-called magical powers are just natural abilities that hobbits and elves have. So that's not magic either. What Tolkien refers to as magic in the strict sense of the word is a sort of magic practiced by the medieval alchemists who are trying to dominate the power of nature through incantations, through spells, as well as by the use of technology. So this is the sort of magic that is condemned by Tolkien and Lewis, as indeed it is condemned by the church. It's what the church calls curiositas, as opposed to wonder. It's an unhealthy curiosity about powers that we have no right to control.
Which in some sense is the avenue taken in Harry Potter.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the trouble with J.K. Rowling, God bless her, is that she doesn't have a truly formed theology or a very rounded philosophy, and therefore she tends to muddle things up. She's a muggle and a muddle, and that's the problem.
Okay, now, the one thing that I'd like to touch upon here is Tolkien's writing of this book. Was it merely for entertainment purposes, or was he actually behind the scenes using it as an evangelization tool?
Well, I don't think he was consciously writing in order to evangelize. In fact, he makes it clear in various places that's not what he's doing. What he's really at root, Tolkien believes that the gift of creativity is a part of, an important part, a central part or an aspect of the divine image in us. We're made in the image of God, and one aspect of the divinity is creativity. God is the creator. He's, if you like, the great artist, the great composer, the great poet. So for Tolkien, just partaking of the gift of creativity is partaking of something divine within us and is good in itself. But he believed that in doing that, especially if you do it with humility and if you do it prayerfully, the truths would emerge naturally from the process. And so that's basically the process he followed. Although he says, coming back to that quote I gave at the beginning, that when Tolkien says the Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, mm-hmm. he continued by saying that it was religious and Catholic unconsciously at first and consciously in the revision. So Tolkien told the story without any conscious desire to evangelize, but then he went back consciously and revised certain parts of the manuscript to make sure it did harmonize with Catholic teaching. And I would suggest that, for instance, giving the date of the destruction of the ring as March the 25th and the date on which the Fellowship of the Ring leave Rivendell is December the 25th are examples of this conscious revision, which is in a sense, albeit subtle, a conscious evangelization.
Got it. Now, the ending. You talk about the ending in your chapter, Heaven Haven, and you point out the fact that Tolkien didn't show Frodo's glimpse of heaven, but rather he ends it with a rather melancholy return home of Sam to his wife and daughter. Why didn't Tolkien push the envelope and go the whole way?
Well, I think the beauty of the ending of The Lord of the Rings is it leaves us where we are. The point is that, you know, that Tolkien, it isn't escapism in the sense of taking us a place where we aren't and can't be. It's taking us from where we are and leaving us back where we are. That we do need to go on the journey. We do need to go on the quest. But we're living in this long defeat. And so, you know, when the Samwise Gamgee goes back home, now in some ways it's a happy ending. You know, he has a wife to return mm-hmm. to and children, and he actually lives a healthy, holy, virtuous life. We know all that. But all of it is nonetheless in the long defeat of a fallen world, what we say in the Salve Regina, in a valley of tears, and in a land of exile. And so it's that melancholy, if you like, which prevails at the end, because, you know, until we actually get to our, please God, heavenly reward, we are living in the world in which Samwise Gamgee is living at the end of a valley of tears and a land of exile.
So we've known that The Lord of the Rings has touched millions of lives. How has it touched your own? Because it seems like in your writing you come back to The Lord of the Rings and you have numerous talks on it as well. So how has this trilogy touched your own life?
Well, I mean, the reading of The Lord of the Rings was a significant milestone on my own conversion to Christianity. When I first read it, I didn't understand all of the Christian dimension, but I could certainly see there was something healthy and ultimately holy in the work itself and in the author of the work. As I reread the work and got to know the work better, all of these Christian dimensions, if you like, deepened in my understanding, and that obviously deepened my understanding not just of The Lord of the Rings, but of my faith. So the Lord of the Rings has been very important as a companion on my life of faith, and I'm very, very privileged. It's become a part of my life as if you like an evangelist, because I'm able, through the talks I give and the books I write and the courses I teach online or in the Catholic Courses series on DVD and CD, I'm able to actually, if you like, evangelize through the power of Tolkien's beauty.
Mm-hmm. Which is pretty awesome stuff. Joseph, I want to thank you for spending time with us today. And before we leave, two things. One, where can people find your work? And two, do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, first of all, people can find Heroes of the Catholic Reformation by going to our Sunday Visitor. I think that's osv.com, but I'm not completely sure. And Frodo's Journey can be by going to tanbooks.com. Or obviously just by checking out online, you can find it just by putting the title and my name in. As for final thoughts, I actually would like to finish, if I may, by thanking you for your own apostolate. Not only have I benefited from your apostolate this time and in the past, but I do think that getting Catholics in the habit of reading the great new books that are being published by so many good authors out there is a very, very important apostolate in itself. And I talked about how privileged I felt in being able to evangelize through the power of beauty, but I think you're doing a very major apostolate in evangelizing through the power of reading and encouraging other people to read. So I'd like to thank you personally, and on behalf of, I'm sure, many, many people out there are benefiting from what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much for that, Joseph. It means a lot. Same with that, we're going to close up today's show. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sachs. Until next time, God bless.